From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. There have been other plagues that changed lives and took lives. Richard Berkowitz endured one of those plagues, and he's with us today. And Richard, I'm wondering if you can count how many friends and loved ones you lost in the 80s and 90s.
Well, it'll be hard to put a number on it, but most of my close circle of gay male friends are gone.
They were just taken.
Some died by suicide, but it was AIDS related. But the rest of them died from AIDS.
Yeah. So the HIV/AIDS plague of the 80s and 90s. Most of your close friends. I mean, can you remind us how it devastated the community?
It was a terrifying time, and we didn't know the cause of AIDS for several years. And a lot of gay men were continuing to have sex, and it was hard to know who to trust. And I mean, as gay men, we didn't have civil rights, and we didn't really trust the media or even the medical establishment. So it was hard to know who to believe and what voices to trust. And so we were kind of cast to the wind. I, myself, was very lucky. It just so happened that the doctor that I saw regularly for sexually transmitted disease checkups turned out to be a lab researcher, like a world-class scientist who was working as a doctor. And so when the TV reports and the newsstands would have stories about the AIDS epidemic, it was impossible to ignore, I went to him and said, you know, am I dying? And he looked at me and said, why do you believe everything you hear? AIDS is much more complicated than that. Mm. And there are things you should do and things you shouldn't do. And you need to get informed about what's going on.
Yeah.
And so he became the voice I trusted. And 38 years later, I'm still here.
Yeah.
So I was very fortunate.
You know, I was thinking in preparation for our conversation today, Richard, I was reminded a very close friend of mine who once was my high school French teacher. I was in high school in the late 80s and early 90s. I remember once I was sitting and having lunch with him when I was still in high school. I think I was like a sophomore or a junior. And we were talking about HIV, AIDS. And, you know, I was like a teenager and it felt really far away. And he started listing all the names of friends and loved ones, and the funerals that he had been to, you know, just in the past couple of years. And it just went on and on and on. And it really hit me at that moment that there was this devastation going on that was made all the worse because it was this disease of intimacy. It was this disease of love, but transmitted through intimate acts. And so, like, how do you ask someone to stop being human, right? I mean, obviously, the best way to prevent it was to stop having sex. I mean, how hard was that to sort of cope with this disease of intimacy?
Oh, it was terrifying. But from the minute I approached my doctor and let him know that I'd woken up to the seriousness of what was going on, we immediately started getting to work on what we could do to minimize or eliminate the risk of getting HIV, or getting AIDS, because HIV hadn't yet been identified. And I just thrust myself into activism, which I'd had a previous history of. And the great thing about activism is that when you're involved in trying to help and protect your own community, you don't really have time to sit and grieve and time to sit and worry. You're actually doing constructive things to try to make the situation better. And you don't realize it at the time, but in trying to save other people's lives, one of the upsides of activism is that you end up maybe saving yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So I wasn't enmeshed in all of the grieving and the tragedy and all that. I was too busy trying to come up with ways to prevent exposure to whatever was causing AIDS and, you know, to promote safe sex, which is, you know, my claim to fame or the thing that came out of my collaboration with my doctor and another of his patients, Michael Callan.
Yeah. So folks who already know your work know that you're Richard Berkowitz and you and Michael Callan co-authored this pamphlet in 1983, this really groundbreaking pamphlet called How to Have Sex in an Epidemic, One Approach. This is why we wanted to talk with you today, Richard, because of the really proactive way that you and Michael wanted to find how can we live our lives, right? How can lives be lived and reduce risk at the same time in the middle of an epidemic? And so before we talk about the pamphlet in detail, can you tell me a little bit about Michael?
Oh my God, I loved Michael. You know, sometimes in life you meet someone and right from the start, there's this connection that just, you know, it doesn't end till one of you die. I mean, we'd both been highly sexually active. We both came out right after the modern gay liberation movement began, after the Stonewall Uprising on Christopher Street in New York City. And by the time we got to New York City in the late 70s, one of the fruits of gay liberation was that there was suddenly this bustling sexual amusement park. And as 20-somethings, we were quite happy to take part in it. And it just seemed like gay life in New York City and San Francisco and L.A. and other places was the promised land. That after growing up being taught to hate ourselves and each other, that we came out in a time of celebration and happiness and sexual freedom. We were riding the wave of the sexual revolution. And it just seemed like life couldn't get better than that. Mm-hmm. We had friends, we had lovers, we had men we had sex with. It was a really joyous time to be alive. So the idea that something would come along to put an end to that was, I mean, it just went to the core of your identity as a gay man or as a sexually active gay man. I mean, most gay men weren't sexually active. Most gay men were looking for boyfriends and relationships. But a lot of gay men like me and Michael Cowan, we just thought, you know, life doesn't get better than being, you know, than being out and part of a community at the dawn of a new movement that was full of joy and human connection.
Yeah. So how did you come up with this idea for this pamphlet? And what was the goal of the pamphlet?
There were two goals of the pamphlet. One is Michael and I were members of the first public support group for gay men with AIDS, because in the beginning it was all gay men with AIDS. It was all gay men who were getting AIDS. And we met at this meeting, and it was obvious to us that gay men who were sick were continuing to have sex. And that the advice that was out there at the time, which was to limit the number of partners you have and choose partners who were healthy, was deadly. Mm-hmm. I mean, we, in discussions with our mutual doctor, Dr. Joseph Sonnabend, who was a virologist and a microbiologist, we realized that there were ways to have sex that could interrupt disease transmission. And that advice, which only focused on numbers and all this vague talk about finding someone who was sick, who was healthy, when so many infections don't produce obvious symptoms, was giving false safety to gay men who needed to know that what was happening was serious, and that if you were going to continue to have sex, there were ways to do it safely.
Yeah. And so when the pamphlet came out in 1983, was it effective? Did gay men read it and say, you know what, I'm going to change my behavior. I'm going to follow this advice and use the tools written here to practice safe sex?
Yeah, I mean, history shows that it had a huge impact on bringing the numbers of sexually transmitted infections among sexually active gay men down right around the time the booklet came out. But it took us years to realize that the booklet went around the world, mm-hmm. that it went to the hinterlands, that it went, that the message was embraced by an entire generation of people. Because in New York City, there's a tendency to get caught up in the activist battles and political confrontations. I mean, when we came out with the booklet, we were really proud of what we'd done. We felt it was state of the art. We felt it could change the world. We felt it could save the community. But we were being accused by gay men on the conservative side of promoting promiscuity at a time of a deadly epidemic. And then we were also at the same time being attacked by queer theorists who felt we were imposing on gay men's sexual freedom to do whatever they wanted sexually.
Uh-huh.
So it was a kind of bizarre double-sided attack. But it was interesting.
So, Richard, can I just tell me? I'm so sorry to interrupt, but that is so fascinating, right? Because feel free to tell me that I'm drawing like an inappropriate thread here. But I hear a same analogy sort of today, right, given COVID, because, you know, on the one hand, the best way to prevent yourself from either transmitting or getting the novel coronavirus is to stay at home, right? It's sort of an abstinence from life model.
Yes.
But then we also have people, and so people are quite judgmental about that. They either resist it or they say it's the only way. And then we have the other end of the extreme, which is, you know, like the carnival model of life. Just like get out there and live, risks be damned. I mean, it feels like there's kind of an analogy here. And that's why
Absolutely. That's why
we wanted to talk to you, because this idea of harm reduction or risk reduction about how to live, how to be human, but also reduce your risks. I mean, you epitomize that with the pamphlet.
Yes, and it can be quite controversial when you try to acknowledge that people aren't all the same, and people get their information from a variety of different places. And the nature of being human is to be connected to other people, whether socially or sexually or in other ways, and that rational people have to find a middle ground where you can live your best life while not denying the seriousness of the situation around you.
That's right. We've got about 30 seconds left before I have to let you go, Richard.
Okay.
How have you been coping? I mean, you're there in New York City. How have you been coping in the NYC lockdown?
When I first heard about coronavirus, my first reaction was, wow, lucky me. I lived long enough to survive one pandemic to be around for another. But the first thing I did was I called Dr. Sonnabend, and I got his advice. And he said to me, of course you can get outside. Of course you can, you know, go on living your life. Just wear a mask when you're inside, wash your hands. You know, the same kind of sensible advice that is written about in Julia's article.
Well, you mentioned Julia Marcus, Dr. Julia Marcus, who we'll be speaking to on the other side of this break. Richard Berkowitz, activist and co-author of the pamphlet How to Have Sex in an Epidemic, One Approach. It was the groundbreaking pamphlet published in 1983. In the middle of the HIV/AIDS epidemic. Thank you so much, Richard, for reminding us of that story and setting us up for a conversation about what harm reduction might mean in this pandemic. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Magna.
We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This hour, we are exploring what a smart solution to loosening restrictions on lockdowns might look like. It doesn't have to be either or. So we want to imagine a different model entirely, not just stay at home forever versus going outside in a carnival-like atmosphere or lives versus the economy. Is there another way? We are constantly looking for that on this show. And today, to help us through that question, we're joined by Julia Marcus. She is an infectious disease epidemiologist at Harvard Pilgrim Healthcare Institute. She's also an assistant professor in the Department of Population Medicine at Harvard Medical School. And a little earlier this month, she wrote a piece in The Atlantic headlined Quarantine Fatigue is Real, and she joins us from Newton, Massachusetts. Professor Marcus, welcome to On Point.
Thanks so much for having me.
So you heard a little bit earlier in the previous segment, you heard Richard Berkowitz describe to us trying to find a middle way in the middle of the HIV/AIDS ultra crisis from the early 80s. You also heard me say, like, do we have sort of an analogous situation here of trying to find a middle way? This is what you wrote about. Do you think it's an analogous situation?
Well, no analogy is perfect,
yeah.
Of course. HIV and COVID-19 are very different in a lot of ways. But I do think there's a lot to learn from what has happened with the HIV epidemic and with public health messaging around HIV. And I like the abstinence analogy, because that's basically what we're looking at here, as you've been talking about, this polarization between going back to business as usual, which we know from every public health expert would be disastrous right now, or staying at home indefinitely and trying to eliminate all risk. And neither of those is a workable option. And similarly with HIV early in the epidemic, you know, the recommendation for gay men to just stop having sex was just not sustainable. And it's not sustainable for any abstinence-only messaging.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about one of the things that you assert early on in your article, that quarantine fatigue is happening, that sort of abstinence from life message is starting to wear thin. Do you see evidence of that in a lot of places? I mean, I think I do, but do you?
Yeah, I mean, I think every day, every person is making choices around how to navigate life right now. And anecdotally, that was not... there is research in terms of how much people are moving around that suggests that quarantine fatigue is happening. But even just anecdotally, hearing from friends and family who are starting to wonder, can I do this thing? Can I do that thing? And it makes sense because some states are starting to think about reopening to some extent. But also there's just this exhaustion from isolating for so long. And it's just not something we can do in the long term at that extreme.
Right. And at the same time, we also have this natural human tendency to be very judgmental of each other for those people who are starting to take some more risks and feel compelled to do so. I think there's a lot of judgment going around on that. I just did a very cursory sort of social media search for a couple of terms, and it just came up with many, many thousands of hits of people just saying, like, how dare you go outside? How dare you forget to take your mask? That kind of thing. So we'll talk about the effect of that judgment in a second. But really, the point that you write about is that there is this concept in public health writ large called harm reduction. It's a strategy. Now, how would you define what harm reduction is?
Harm reduction is a strategy that's in some ways the opposite of abstinence only. It's a strategy that meets people where they are, meaning it accepts that people are going to take some amount of risk, that asking people to abstain from whatever it is that we may be concerned about, whether it's sex or substance use, asking them to abstain indefinitely is just not sustainable for everyone. And by accepting that some people are going to take some risks, it gives us an opportunity to give them strategies that they can use to reduce harms in those situations.
Right. And so we've seen this deployed, for example, in substance abuse disorder treatment, right? I think I've seen pretty frequently harm reduction strategies recommended to patients, like clean needles, that kind of thing. Professor Marcus, are you there?
I am. I'm sorry. I'm not sure where I lost you.
It's okay. I was just talking about how we have seen examples of harm reduction strategies being employed or used, for example, with substance abuse disorder treatments.
That's right. I think that's probably where it's most commonly used in a very explicit way, but it's certainly the core tenet around safer sex education and HIV prevention strategies that aren't asking people for abstinence, but rather giving them strategies that they can use to reduce harms if they do choose to have sex, which ultimately many people will.
Okay. Well, and so tell me then, what might harm reduction look like, or what are we talking about with regards to lockdown versus no lockdown?
Well, I think we can accept that people cannot stay home only interacting with their households or only themselves if they are the only people in their households indefinitely. And so as people start to think about ways that they can live their lives, what are strategies we can give them to support lower risk, but not necessarily zero risk activities? And you could think about public health guidance that gives people a sense of a spectrum of risk rather than just telling people stay home.
And I mean, perhaps this is premature to ask, but what might that guidance look like? I mean, didn't we actually see that a little bit before lots of states went into full lockdown, that we saw that ratcheting down of like, okay, you can be in a room with 50 people, then it went down to 10. I mean, is that what you're talking about or something completely different?
Well, I'm not sure how intentional that ratcheting down was so much as, it wasn't immediately clear, I think, how to shut things down and the extent to which we needed to shut things down. Mm-hmm. And so it kind of took a step-by-step process. I'm thinking more about, for example, some guidance that came out of the New York City Health Department recently. And that's a health department that's very progressive in terms of their approach on to harm reduction. And they put out guidance that I talked about in the Atlantic piece, specifically for sexual health during COVID-19. And it says very clearly, the safest thing you can do right now is just be home. So your safest sex partner is yourself. But it implicitly acknowledges that some people are going to have sex. And so it kind of goes through this spectrum of risk of, you know, you may have a partner within your household. So things to think about, has that partner potentially been recently exposed? Do they have symptoms? You know, trying to work through what are the ways to mitigate risk in that situation. And in the end, it also implicitly acknowledges that despite our best efforts and despite this guidance, some people may go and have sex outside of their households right now. And it also provides strategies on how to reduce risk in that situation. So it's not promoting risk taking. It's acknowledging that there are going to be some people who take risks and that they deserve guidance too.
Right. And in fact, you also write about that beyond even the acknowledgement that some people are going to take risks. In the COVID context, you write that public health experts have an opportunity to acknowledge that the desire to see family members, like we have... for example, we've got comments coming in online. Carol Cottom says, I miss seeing my children and grandchildren in person. We live far away from each other, but used to try to visit every 2 to 2.5 months. It's now been 4.5 months since we were together. Carol says she's grateful for video calls, but it's not the same. I mean, that's just one example of how perhaps the mental health benefits of once again being in closer physical proximity of your loved ones might be a part of the overall picture of the public's health right now. Can you tell me about that a little bit?
Absolutely. I think we have a tendency to focus on disease prevention as the end all be all. And of course, the primary focus here needs to be on maximizing life, saving lives. But we also need to maximize quality of life. And when people are becoming acutely depressed from isolation, that's something that's worth considering in terms of the overall picture of health. And I'm not saying, you know, that's a reason to just fully open things up. But for somebody who is really suffering right now, there may be ways to interact with other people that are fairly low risk. And so that's where the guidance comes in as a way to support people in making those decisions so that, you know, the person who is really struggling because they're not seeing their grandkids, is there a way for them to see their grandkids with maybe not zero risk, but very, very low risk, staying 6 feet apart, sitting in a yard, you know, not sharing food. And without the guidance that gives us a sense of how to mitigate risks in those situations, people may suffer unnecessarily, either by throwing it all to the wind or interacting with business as usual, or really just continuing to feel depressed and isolated, which is also not what we want.
Right. Well, what is your response to people, I mentioned this before, who look at even slight changes in behavior now that are different from the advice to stay at home as much as possible with extreme judgment, because they're saying, and I don't actually think they're wrong, and you don't think they're wrong either, Professor Marcus, but like that we're not there yet, and that really the sort of abstinence from life mode is we need to stick with it for a while longer to really not just bend or flatten the curve, but to crush it right now.
Yeah, I would say I agree. And to the extent that someone is able to continue what we've been doing, great. I think as much as we can continue to minimize risk, that's what we need to do. But I would also say it's unrealistic for some people. And if we don't acknowledge that, we're missing an opportunity to support people in engaging in low risk activities. And you know, it's just not, it's not sustainable in the long term. And now that we've realized this is something that we're not just doing for 2 months, we may be doing this for many, many months, if not years, we have to figure out a way to do it such that people can feel like they're living their lives, even if it's not the normal that we were used to before COVID emerged.
Right. And I mean, we're getting a lot of response from our listeners online about if they're experiencing quarantine fatigue. Karen Gleesberg And Karen, sorry if I said your last name incorrectly, but Karen wrote us to say, I'm so much less active. As a first grade teacher, I was constantly moving, checking in on kids, etc. And now I sit behind a computer for a million hours a day and can't fall asleep at night. I wake up exhausted and do the whole thing all over again. But you write in the Atlantic article, Professor Marcus, about quarantine shaming, though, and your concerns about it. Can you tell us, first of all, how do you describe or would define quarantine shaming?
Well, I'm a recent social media user, so maybe this is something that I would have been more used to had I been on social media for years. But, you know, watching just this rampant shaming over the last few weeks of pictures of people who are at beaches, pictures of people who are at parks, and some, you know, one of the ones that got sent around a lot that I mentioned in the article was a video of a house party happening in New York City that people were really angry about. And I mean, it got to the point where I felt like that was half of what I was seeing on my feed. And it's understandable. It's really, it can be very enraging. And I think especially, I can only imagine what frontline health workers feel when they see a video of people having a house party right now. And it must feel just incredibly disrespectful. At the same time, what we know from HIV research is that shaming people doesn't often have the effect that we want it to have. Rather than, you know, encouraging people to stop engaging in risky behaviors, it just drives those behaviors underground. Mm-hmm. So next time those people have a house party in New York, they're not going to post it on Instagram. But I don't know that the shaming is going to prevent them from having the house party at all. And in fact, when it's not being posted on Instagram, we don't know that it's happening. And so we can't provide them with tools to reduce risk should they choose to have a party.
Right. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. So one thing that I think that is central to any kind of guidance that's put out that's not just strictly shelter at home or complete opening is clarity and trust, right? Clarity in what the guidance is for various scenarios or situations. And we're talking about a whole spectrum of possible behaviors or scenarios. And then also trust in leadership. And I think that that's latter one is problematic. Do you think that there's a limit to how effective any kind of harm reduction-based guidance could be, given that there's so little trust in leadership in America right now?
Yeah, we're in a very unfortunate situation in terms of trust in science and trust in public health leadership, especially given how little we've seen in terms of national public health leadership over these last couple months. And I think, you know, the best we're going to be able to do is, you know, hopefully the CDC is going to be able to release some public health guidance that we know they've developed. And I hope that it comes from a harm reduction perspective. In the absence of that, we need to see state and local health departments step in to develop that guidance. But I agree with you. I think there is some erosion of trust that is going to make it really difficult to move forward over these next few months.
Yeah. Well, we have a comment that's come in from Sarah N.K., and she says, I have fatigue for the news and lack of adherence to scientific guidance. She misses easily talking to people and watching her kids go swimming and out and about. But she says that would be easier to take if I trusted leaders and fellow citizens to take care of each other. So, I mean, Professor Marcus, in the absence of that trust, how would you advise people? I mean, if you're saying that we ought to be looking for another way, but folks aren't sure about the guidance that they would be getting from certain leaders, what would you tell them to do?
Well, I personally still feel that the CDC is a trusted source of brilliant, hardworking epidemiologists and health experts. I think what has happened is we haven't been able to hear from them because of the way the administration has approached this pandemic. So my hope is still that we will be able to hear from them and that we will remember that the CDC has been historically a very trusted organization. And you know, I would encourage people also to remember that science evolves over time and it's evolving so rapidly right now. And so some of the mixed messages that people feel they're hearing from scientists are not about, you know, scientists trying to confuse people. It really is that science is rapidly developing and we're just doing the best we can. And so some of it I think is also about just having an understanding of, you know, things need to change. So one of the things that people I think have been very frustrated about is the messaging around masks changing, quite dramatically. I think what would help is for public health leaders and scientists who are kind of the forefront of this to acknowledge that things are changing and try to rebuild that trust as much as possible.
Exactly. Well, Julia Marcus, stand by here for just a moment. We're talking about how concepts of harm reduction might help us find a way past the either-or dichotomy of, quote-unquote, opening up the economy again. Professor Marcus has written about this in The Atlantic with a piece headlined, Quarantine Fatigue is Real. We've got a link to it at onpointradio.org, and we'll be right back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Ali Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to be talking about this week in the news. And we want to know, are you one of the 36 million Americans who've lost their jobs in the past couple of months? What do you want? What do you need from the next congressional aid package, if indeed it happens? And what do you make of Dr. Anthony Fauci's extremely cautious outlook for the fall? Or on the other hand, are you really glad that some states are beginning to relax restrictions? Those are some of the questions we love to hear your stories and answers to. So call us with your experiences and your questions at 617-353-0683. You can leave a voicemail there. That's 617-353-0683. That's for tomorrow's show. Today, we're talking about how the concept of harm reduction might be extremely useful right now as we all try to find our way forward and are suffering from quarantine fatigue. Julia Marcus joins us. She's an assistant professor in the Department of Population Medicine at Harvard Medical School, and she wrote about this issue in a May 11th piece in The Atlantic headlined Quarantine Fatigue is Real. And there's a link to her piece at onpointradio.org. And Professor Marcus, if you can just hang in here for a little bit, I want to introduce now into the conversation Matthew Liao. He joins us from New York City. He's director of the Center for Bioethics and a professor of bioethics at the NYU School of Global Public Health. Professor Liao, welcome to you.
Thank you. Hi, Meghna.
Hi. And first and foremost, what do you, just broadly speaking, what do you think of this idea that we can apply the tenets of harm reduction or risk reduction to managing behaviors around the COVID-19 pandemic?
So I think that it might be too early to apply harm reduction to COVID-19 for a couple of reasons. I mean, one is that I really like Professor Marcus's article. I read it, but I think there are a couple of disanalogies between sort of COVID-19 and sort of the HIV case or just harm reduction in general. So for one thing, the action, so sort of in the case of sex or drug use, the action is very clear. It's very specific. But in the case of sort of the, you know, sort of COVID-19, what we're we don't really know, like, sort of people are going to do what they're going to do anyways. What are they going to do? Go to the park or go to work or go meet with their families? You know, it's the action is not very clear. And then the other thing is just that the rate of transmission for the for COVID-19 is just way greater. And so, you know, in the case of sex, it's very isolated. It's sort of, you know, it's individual to individual. But in the case of COVID-19, you can be transmitting just by walking. You know, you could be running. You could be shedding viruses, you know, just through the streets, things that you touch and things like that. And so we have a lot less control over this particular virus compared to the other HIV or even drug use.
Right. So I just to be clear, I think there's universal agreement at this table right now between the three of us that the means of transmission and the rate of infection is not between COVID-19 and HIV AIDS is not analogous at all. I'm glad you made that point. But yeah. I think the bigger point is that and there is truth to this because we've seen it time and again is that there is a degree of people do get exhausted by abstinence only recommendations, whether it's for sex or any other kinds of human behaviors. There's just a limit to the tolerance for that. And so when you say, you know, people are going to do what they're going to do, what does that mean? Well, it means anything, right? Because we're talking about humanity. It can mean all sorts of behaviors, which I think is exactly why Professor Marcus is suggesting, well, we do need some guidance. Some kinds of guidance. So I'll give you an example, and forgive me for droning on, but I think it's a relevant one. So I'm here in Massachusetts, and we've been with some kind of restrictive orders for quite some time now. And in just the past couple of weeks, I don't know if it's the weather or what, but we have seen many more people out on the streets, many more cars out on the road. Businesses haven't yet begun opening up, but people are going somewhere. Like, something's happening. People have reached their tolerance limit. So isn't that exactly why smart guidance on risk reduction might be more necessary than ever?
I mean, I completely agree. I think that, people go out every day anyways. I mean, I'm in New York City, so you see on the streets people are walking. But right now what they're doing is they're walking, but they're wearing masks. And they're trying to sort of do social distancing and things like that. And so I think those guidances are very helpful, and we should try to encourage them. So I'm all in favor of those types of guidances. I just think that another thing that we need to keep in mind is that just unlike HIV, there's a huge harm to innocent bystanders in this case. So, you know, in a case of sex, it's typically consensual. And so, you know, you kind of know what you're getting into, but people around you don't have a choice of whether to get infected or not in the case of COVID-19. So your grandmother could get infected, or your family members could get infected because of your behavior. And I just think that, you know, we need to keep that in mind as well as we come up with these guidances on, you know, sort of what to do.
Mm. Professor Marcus, how would you like to respond?
Yeah, I mean, it goes back to the point that this is not necessarily a perfect analogy, but no analogy is perfect. And I think there's still a lot to learn here. And I wanted to also respond to Professor Lau's point about, you know, this, it's not just one thing. We're not just talking about sex. We're talking about a range of different behaviors. And that's absolutely true. And I think that's kind of what I was looking for when it sounded like we were about to see public health guidance from the CDC. From what we know about that guidance, it did break things down into different settings, into schools and workplaces and churches And so you can imagine guidance that gives you a sense of, all right, when you're socializing, here's kind of the spectrum of risk and things you can do to reduce risk in each type of scenario. Same thing for schools, same thing for churches. So yeah, it's definitely, it's complex, but I think it's doable. And I think it's something that we need to work toward.
Professor Liao, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I agree with Professor Marcus. I was just disheartened that, you know, the CDC's guideline wasn't made available to the public initially, and is still being made available in a truncated form. I read the one that was circulated online, and it was a lot more specific. And what I specifically liked about it was that it also talked about how you know, we might need to close again if certain things were to happen, you know, sort of maybe when the hospitals, you know, we're running out, you know, if we ran out of hospital beds again, then we need to be prepared to close the economy again. I think those are the measures that we really need to be thinking about. You know, we need that kind of flexibility. I completely agree with Professor Marcus that, you know, we need to try to do this in a rational manner and try to provide guidance to people so that they have ideas of what they can do and what they shouldn't be doing. And in that respect, I think that, just to say one other thing, I think we should have more, maybe look into contact-facing apps to maybe coordinate people going out versus people staying in. You know, like there are technologies that we can employ to facilitate the type of things that Professor Marcus wants to promote.
Yeah. So about that CDC guidance, I'm looking here. The Associated Press, I think just yesterday, obtained a rather detailed document here, the CDC guidance that's more than 60 pages long. This is the one that the White House shelved. And we're going to put a link to that document released by the Associated Press on our website, onpointradio.org. Professor Liao, let me just ask you, speaking of the CDC, I want to just play a moment of tape from the Senate Health Committee hearing that happened earlier this week on Tuesday. And here, Democratic Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut asks CDC Director Dr. Robert Redfield about the fact that the White House shelved that detailed guidance for reopening the country that the CDC had been working on for months. And here is Dr. Redfield's response.
As we work through the guidances, a number of them go for interagency review and interagency input to make sure that these guidances are more broadly applicable for different parts of our society. The guidances that you've talked about have gone through that interagency review. There are comments that have come back to CDC, and I anticipate they'll go back up into the task force for final review.
Well, Senator Murphy was not satisfied with that, and he continued to press Dr. Redfield for a clearer release timeline.
But we're reopening in Connecticut in 5 days, in 10 days. I mean, this guidance isn't going to be useful to us in 2 weeks. So is it this week? Is it next week? When are we going to get this expertise from the federal government?
The other thing I will just say is that the CDC stands by to give technical assistance to your state and any state upon any request. I do anticipate this broader guidance, though, to be posted on the CDC website soon.
That's Dr. Robert Redfield, director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, at a Senate hearing on Tuesday. Professor Liao, can you make sense of that? Like, what is Dr. Redfield saying? That is this guidance going to come out even though the White House shelved it, and when?
It sounds like there's a bit of back and forth. They're kind of negotiating. I think he's already, it's already been signed off, but then it was shelved. And now, because of the public pressure, because it was sort of, my take is that because of the public pressure, they're now saying, they're kind of backtracking and sort of saying that, well, some form of it, we're still reviewing it, some form of it might come out. Mm. On the government's website, there are some versions of it. It's not as detailed as the CDC's guideline, mm-hmm. which I thought the CDC's guideline was particularly helpful for the reasons that Professor Marcus had given, namely that it was very specific. It sort of said, these are the conditions for, you know, like what restaurants need to do, for example, or parks or schools and so on and so forth.
Right. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. Professor Marcus, I mean, I'd like to just hear more from you on what you think about the fact that the CDC has not been front and center, in fact, throughout this crisis, but especially in the past couple of weeks, as we're trying to wrestle with what is the best and safest way to reopen states.
Yeah, I mean, it's a real there's so much to say about how this pandemic has played out at a federal level. But just focusing on the silence of the CDC, we've really needed them here. And I think the result of having silence from our national public health organization is that this has the pandemic has become politicized. And I think that's why we've seen this the development of this binary, you know, all or nothing approach to prevention, because we're not hearing that nuance that we need to hear from public health leaders.
Yeah. Listen, we've got some really interesting comments coming in on Twitter. The GF sent us this tweet, quote, "This discussion feels like it's coming from a point of amazing privilege. The anger you see on social media comes in part from black and brown people who are dying at higher rates so that others can party and get haircuts." Professor Liao, would you like to respond to that?
Yeah, so I agree. That's why I think that we need to do more than just at least currently than just harm reduction, because there are a lot of people who are already out there. They're delivering groceries. They have to work. These essential workers, and they tend to be people of color. And I really feel for those people. And so in the context of that, if we're sort of worried about whether we can go jogging and things like that, I just think that we as a society can do a bit more to help each other out, to have this kind of solidarity. Certainly we don't know enough about COVID yet and its effects, so the science is still coming in. So, for example, we just learned that children can get Kawasaki-like diseases. And so this is sort of new things that we're finding. And so and that has implications for, say, reopening of schools. And so I think that until more facts come in, we really need to be much more careful about reopening the economy or the schools.
Professor Marcus, your thoughts?
Yeah, I'm really glad that that person brought up the question of privilege here, because I actually think that's one of the reasons why the shaming is so dangerous. We see shaming as being you can think of it as being on a spectrum where the next step from shaming is criminalization. And when we look at what's happening, particularly in New York right now, around policing of social distancing violations, the vast majority of people who are being ticketed and being arrested are black and brown people who are already the people who are hardest hit by this pandemic. So I think keeping in mind this spectrum of risk at all levels of society is going to help with reducing the amount that we are cracking down on people who are already getting it, from both ends.
Yeah, I would agree completely. And to the point of this conversation coming from a place of privilege, I would also note that it's not, I keep coming back to this, we do not have to live in a world where it's either zero or the red zone. I mean, we're trying really hard to find ways for dynamic solutions, right, that take into account, yes, the dangers and threats to all people, including people of color, or especially people of color, not just in terms of their health, but also, you know, their economic well-being. The economy shutting down is harming them more than possibly others. So that's just sort of my cri de coeur about our efforts, and I hope our collective efforts to find dynamic solutions to this problem and not absolutist ones. So Professor Julia Marcus, assistant professor in the Department of Population Medicine at Harvard Medical School, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Meghna.
And Matthew Liao, director of the Center for Bioethics and a professor of bioethics at NYU School of Global Public Health. Professor Liao, thank you.
Thank you, Meghna.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.